All right, listen, I'd like to pick up where we left off in the book of Job. I believe that we had left off on chapter 12. All right, I get to reading this back and forth, and I forget where I left off. But for those of you who weren't here when we started this book, just in a way, a real brief review or, you know, an overview of what's taking place here is that Job, as far as God was concerned, was a righteous man, blameless and upright and not righteous. There was none like him in all the world. Anyway, this challenge went out to the devil, and the devil basically told God, look, Job, he's only serving you because you've been so good to him. I mean, look at everything he owns. You build a hedge around him. He's the richest man around, and he's got a big family, and he just has all these material things. And so he's not serving you for nothing. I mean, you pay him well. I see. So the devil basically said, take away everything you've given him, and he'll curse you to your face. So long story short, the devil was allowed to go forth, and he killed his 10 children. He took away all of his livestock, his camels, his sheep, his oxen. Everything he owned was taken from him. And then when everything was taken from him, and it was all taken from him in just a matter of hours, Job just tore his robes and shaved his hair in humility and prostrated himself before God and said, naked I came from my mother's womb and naked I shall return. And he continued to worship God. And then sometime later, I don't know exactly what the time frame was or the timeline, but the devil came before God again, and God said to him, hey, have you considered my servant Job? He says, look, you enticed me to take everything away from him, and he hasn't cursed me. And the devil, you know, he just says, oh, man, skin for skin. A guy will do anything to save his hiney. He says, hey, you take away his health, and he'll curse you to his face. So God said, okay, listen, you can take away his health, but you can't touch him. And then the devil goes forth and touches him, and he's just covered from boils from head to toe. And apparently he had lost everything. He said, even his own wife basically, you know, disowned him. She said, why don't you just curse God and die? And apparently he was basically run out of his own household, went over to his tent or wherever he was living, because it says that he was sitting among the ashes, which gives the indication that he was sitting in a garbage dump where they burn all of the refuse and the garbage. He's sitting there all by himself, homeless, complete, and lost everything, and he's in excruciating pain. He's got boils all over the place, and he's got this broken piece of pottery, and he's scraping the pus out of his boils, you know, in the midst of a garbage dump. And that's how far down he had fallen from his estate. And then three of his friends, it was Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, they had heard of all of his misfortune, and they came to comfort him, and they saw him from afar off, and they just really, really were moved by what they saw, because I guess he became emaciated. He became I don't know, he just really, really looked terrible, and they probably hardly even recognized him. And then they began, I mean, when they saw him, all they could do was just sit with him, and they sat with him for like 7 days. Nobody said a word, but then right after the 7 days, there was a spirit, and obviously it was the devil, that appeared in a form, in a phantom-like form, before Eliphaz. But apparently he was the oldest friend of Job, and he posed a question to Eliphaz, basically saying, hey, can a man be pure before God? Suggesting that Job is in this mess because Job has got sin in his life, and he is a big hypocrite. So Eliphaz begins to, in a very tactful way, try to bring this across to Job, that Job, you know, you're suffering like this because there must be something wrong in your life. And so he goes along with this discourse for some, and then Job responds to him and says, hey, man, I'm innocent. I haven't done anything. And then Bildad jumps in, and he just is a lot less tactful and says, oh, Job, you know, you're lying. There's something wrong with you. You got some hidden sin. This is, God just doesn't punish people like this for nothing. And Eliphaz was basing his observations on what he had seen and what he had experienced in his life, and Bildad was basing his argument on the fact that he said, look in past generations, look at the tradition, and it will show you that God always blesses the righteous and always punishes the wicked. And then Zophar jumps in, and he really lays into Job and basically calling Job a liar, and he's full of hot air and everything. So the poor guy, he is just down and out, okay? So basically, this is what we're going to pick up in this chapter 12, is Job's response, and he's responding to Zophar, but he's also responding to his other friends. And he says in this verse 1 in chapter 12, he says, then Job responded, truly then, you are the people, and with you, wisdom will die. In other words, what he's saying that you guys all wisdom is wrapped up in you, and when you die, all wisdom is going to die with you. In other words, he's being very, very sarcastic, thinking, you guys think you know it all. You don't know what's going on here. In verse 3, it says, but I have intelligence as well as you. I am not inferior to you. And who does not know the such things as these? In other words, they were saying a lot of things that were true, but then a lot of things were just completely out of context, and a lot of things were just completely misapplied. And so he's saying, hey, you know, basically God does bless the righteous, and basically the wicked are eventually punished. I mean, that's very obvious, but that's not always the case. It's just that Job is refuting their argument. Again, in verse 4, it says, I am a joke to my friends, the one who called on God, and he answered him, the just and the blameless man is a joke. In other words, what he's saying is, it's like, I've seen this so many times over the years, and I think I've just experienced myself. As a matter of fact, I even experienced it today. One of the managers had said something to the effect that he was talking to one of the salespeople, and he said something like, yeah, John's a Christian. You know, he's liable to go postal on us or something like that. You know, you can't trust the guy. I don't know. I just become the butt of a lot of people's jokes. But what he's saying here is that, hey, when other people were down and out, he was out there always for these people, and now he basically has become a butt end of people's joke, or kind of a proverb to people, because they're saying, oh, Job, the big phony, the big hypocrite, you know, all this time we thought he was such a righteous, godly man, and look, at his true colors are coming out, because there's no way if he was righteous and godly that he would be in this dire straits that he's in. This is people's logic. We are told in Samuel that God judges by the heart, and man judges by outward appearance, and this is what everybody was doing to him. People who once held him in high esteem, they're now mocking him. He's a butt end of jokes. He can't get any lower than what he's going. In verse 5, he says, he who is at ease holds calamity in contempt, as prepared for those whose feet slip. What he says here, I think I commented upon it a little bit the other night. This statement, he who is at ease holds calamity in contempt, it seems to be just a fact of life, okay, that people who are rich and they're well off and they have everything going their way, when other people run into a lot of calamity or difficulties or trials or setbacks or disappointments or, you know, whatever, they almost have this air of superiority. And I've seen it so many times over the years that they kind of hold these people almost in disregard or kind of hold them like they're beneath them. I mean, I've seen this, and that's what Job is saying. He's basically, I think, pointing it to his friends, too. He's looking at his friends, and they're at ease. They're not taking pity upon him. They're not getting down where the rubber meets the road and putting their arms around him and saying, Job, I don't understand what's happening in your life, but, you know, I'm here for you. I don't know what I could do for you, but let's pray. I'll see you through this. Instead, they turned on him. And so he says in verse 6, he says, the tents of the destroyers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure, whom God brings into his power. But now ask the beasts and let them teach you, and the birds of the heavens and let them tell you, or speak to the earth and let it teach you, and let the fish of the sea declare to you, who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this, in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind? Does not the ear test words as the palate tastes food? In other words, what he's saying is, okay, who doesn't know that in essence, God blesses the righteous, but at the same time, you know, he punishes the wicked. But he's saying, too, that that's not always the case. He says, just look around you. He says, I mean, even nature will tell you. I mean, just ask the birds, ask the fish, ask nature. And you can see it, that it's not always a rule of thumb where God blesses the righteous and punishes the wicked. I mean, look at nature. Look at how God will use nature to chastise men or to try to get men's attention. But the righteous suffer right along with the wicked. That tsunami they had almost a year ago, I saw a situation where it wiped out almost a whole village, but a church was left standing. But then in other disasters, a church will be completely wiped out and other buildings will be left standing. So, I mean, you know, you can't say, well, God spares his own all the time. It just doesn't happen. Why? Because God's thoughts on our thoughts, his ways on our ways. I mean, you know, he is way beyond our understanding, and he just doesn't do things the way we think they should be done. And, you know, this is Job's argument to his friends. In verse 12, he says, wisdom is with aged men, with long life is understanding. Now, this is a general rule of thumb, right? But it's not always true. Wisdom is with the age. I mean, I've seen a lot of old fools running around, and I've seen a lot of old fools running this country. You know what I'm saying? Wisdom doesn't necessarily come with age, right? And he says here, with long life is understanding. You know, I mean, I look around and I see some of these people that, like I said, they've been in power and they've been there for years and years and years. And I don't see what they have any insight or understanding. So what he's saying here is, hey, you know, as a general rule of thumb, certain things may apply, but it's not always the case. In verse 13, he says, with him are wisdom and might. To him belong counsel and understanding. Behold, he tears down and it cannot be rebuilt. He imprisons a man and there can be no release. Behold, he restrains the water and they dry up, and he sends them out and they inundate the earth. With him are strength and sound wisdom. The misled and the misleader belong to him. He makes counselors walk barefoot and makes fools of judges. He loosens the bonds of kings and binds their loins with a girdle. He makes priests walk barefoot. He overthrows the secure ones. He deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on nobles and loosens the belt of the strong. He reveals mysteries from the darkness and brings the deep darkness into light. He makes the nations great and destroys them. He enlarges the nations and he leads them away. He deprives intelligence of chiefs of the earth's people and makes them wander in pathless waste. They grope in darkness with no light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man. In other words, what he's saying here, he's given one example after example after example of where God will very often do the opposite of what we expect or what we think. And he uses different analogies here, basically, like, you know, he'll turn judges into fools, or, you know, the very people who should know better, or, you know, he'll take people who are positions of power and reduce them to nothing. He take people that are very secure, and that everything will be turned on its head for them. People who are, you can trust as far as their speech is concerned, to always be saying the right thing. They'll be speechless and not know what to do or what to say in certain situations. This is what he's saying as far as God is concerned. And hey, you can't take God and you can't put him in a classroom and dissect him. You can't put him in a little box and say, this is the way God always works. And I see this all the time. I see it with people in various churches, if they have a particular doctrine or a particular belief that they try to promote. They say that, you know, basically, unless you do things their way, God doesn't bless it, or he's not going to recognize it, or it's not going to be approved. There's any number of examples you can use. I'm just simply saying this. We always got to understand something. Not only is God's thoughts way above our own, but he is totally sovereign. Like I said, some people feel like, well, you can't be saved because you didn't have the same experience that I had or that our church teaches or whatever, and at the same time say, hey, man, God is sovereign. You can't dictate to him how he's going to act or how he needs to orchestrate things, because he always does things his way. I mean, even Jesus said, when he talked about the parable of the talents, you know, he said that, hey, man, the guy with the one talent, he turned his talent back into his master and says, hey, I knew you were a hard and exacting man, sowing where you don't reap and reaping where you don't sow. In other words, hey, that's exactly what God does many, many times. So what Job is basically saying is his rebuttal to them is, hey, man, you can't tell me that God always blesses the righteous and always curses or punishes the wicked this side of eternity, because his experience bears us out that that's not the case. Because he gives, like I said, he gave so many examples here to show that, hey, God just turns everything on its ear and turns everything upside down in his own good way, in his own good time, for his own good reasons. And no man could sit there and say, hey, man, you know, God's made a mistake, because he's in total complete charge. Anybody have anything to add or share to that chapter 12? Okay, this chapter 13, he continues his discourse, you know, his rebuttal to his friends, when he says, behold, my eye has seen all this, and my ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I am not inferior to you. In other words, what his friends were saying, a lot of what they were saying was true. But Job said, hey, man, I'm not inferior to you. I've seen these things. I know what's going on. You're not telling me anything new. And he says in verse 3, he says, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God. So now he's directing his dialogue, he's turning it to God. And what he's basically saying is, I want to talk to God. You know, you guys are no help to me. I want to confront God. I want to talk to him. And what's interesting is, when we read further on in this discourse of Job, you consider the fact that Job lost his children, he lost his home, he lost all of his wealth, he lost everything, he lost his health, and now he's just homeless in a garbage dump, and he doesn't even have any friends. I mean, he's just, you can't get any lower than him, right? I mean, the guy, you know, has just lost it all. But you know what really, really tormented him the most? Was that he says that he can't find God. When we read on further, he says, you know, I look behind me, I can't see him. I look above me, I can't find him. I can't perceive him. I look to the right, I look to the left. I can't find God. That was his biggest frustration, because he thought, if I could just get a hold of him, if I could just talk to him as a man talks to a man, if I could just talk to him face to face, I mean, I could plead my case before him. And so, you know, this is what he's saying here. He says in verse 3, he says, but I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God, but you smear with lies. You are all worthless physicians. Oh, that you would be completely silent, and that would become your wisdom. Please hear my argument and listen to my contentions of my lips. Will you speak what is unjust for God, and speak what is deceitful for him? Will you show partiality for him? Will you contend for God? Will it be well when he examines you, or will you deceive him as one deceives a man? He will surely reprove you if you secretly show partiality. Will not his majesty terrify you, and the dread of him fall on you? Your memorable sayings are proverbs of ashes, and your defenses are defenses of clay. And basically he's saying this, he says, you guys are trying to speak for God, and you're putting words into God's mouth, and what you're saying is just completely utter nonsense. In other words, what Job's friends thought they were doing is they just felt like, hey man, we need to defend God here. We need to come to God's aid. God is obviously punishing Job for some hidden wickedness in his life, and therefore, you know, we're going to speak for God, on behalf of God. And Job is reproving him them for that. And, you know, there are people that do this. That's why the Bible says, hey, judge not, lest you be judged, because we don't know all the facts. Only God knows the hidden motives of the heart. Only God can discern exactly what's going on in a person's mind or heart or life. A lot of times we may feel like some of the most holy people or the righteous people on the earth. Hey, man, you know, all that's going to come out on Judgment Day. Some of the people that we don't give a second thought to as far as their spirituality, they may shine brighter than the stars. And some of the people that we think are really going to get great rewards in the end, we might find that they might even not even make it, you know, because God is the one, you know, who knows exactly what's going on. I mean, like Jeremiah said, the heart's deceitful above all things. It's desperately wicked. Nobody knows the inner workings of the heart but God. In other words, hey, he's the only one who can judge, because he's the only one who sees everything right. But these people stood in the place of God, and they became Job's judge, and they condemned him. And as far as Job was concerned, he says everything that they were saying or the proverbs that they were using were nothing but ashes, and the defenses were nothing but worthless clay as far as he was concerned. And then he says in that verse 13, he says, be silent before me so that I may speak. Then let what may come on me. Why should I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life into my hands? In other words, what he's saying, and he's saying it in a poetic way, but what he's basically saying is this. He's going to talk to God now. You know, he's basically told them, why don't you guys shut up, because I'm going to talk to God. And talking to God, I realize I'm going to take my life into my own hands. That's what it means here, where it says, why should I take my flesh into my teeth and put my life into my hands? He's just basically realizing that when I come before God, he can slay me with a glance. He realizes that, you know, no mortal man is going to be able to stand in the presence of God. He realizes that. But he's determined, you know, that he wants to talk to God. He wants to talk to him face to face. And he realizes that's a very risky thing to want, you know, because he realizes, hey, man, I'm just a man with feet of clay, man. I'm just a flesh and bones. He's an all-consuming fire of holiness, you know, and yet he's compelled to want to get into his presence because he's compelled to speak to him. So he says here in verse 15, though he slay me, I will hope in him, or though he slay me, I will trust in him. In other words, he recognizes, okay, if I go into God's presence, he can slay me, but I'm still going to trust, I'm still going to hope, all right, that he will treat me right. He says, nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him. He says, this also will be my salvation, for the godless man may not come before his presence. So basically, he's asserting to his friends that he is upright, that he is blameless, that there isn't anything in his heart that he can detect that would where he would deserve this kind of punishment in his life. So he feels like, okay, I have a clear conscience, and this is what's going to enable me to stand before God and talk to him. He says here in verse 17, listen carefully to my speech and let my declarations fill your ears. Behold, now I have prepared my case. I know that I will be vindicated. Who will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die. In other words, he's prepared to talk to God, but he's saying this. If anybody can prove me wrong, if anybody can substantiate sin in my life, then I will just close my mouth and I will just die. That, basically, that's what he's saying, that verse 19. Who will contend with me? For then I would be silent and die. In other words, if you can prove me wrong, if you can prove that I'm an evildoer, then I will shut my mouth and just die. All right, but he's pleading his innocence here, and he's basically demanding an audience with God to face to face so that he can clear this up. Verse 20 says, only two things do not do to me, then I will not hide from thy face. He says, remove thy hand from me, and let not the dread of thee terrify me. In other words, what he's saying is, okay, I'm going to come before God, but there's two things he's asking God. And that's basically, don't overwhelm me with your presence. In other words, don't terrify me to such a degree that I won't be able to even speak. And he's also, he says that, verse 21, remove thy hand from me. Some manuscripts may say something, worded just a little bit different, but what I think he's basically saying is either remove this heaviness from me, or in other words, your punishment from me, or sustain me with your hand. Either way, I think it's basically saying the same thing. He's saying, sustain me in your presence, and then don't terrify me with your presence, that I won't be so intimidated that I can't speak to you. Then he says here in that verse 22, then call and I will answer, or let me speak and then reply to me. So he's basically saying to God, okay, Lord, you can speak first if you want. If not, let me speak. You know, he's just throwing out this challenge to God to communicate with him. In verse 23, he says, how many are my iniquities and my sins? Make known to me my rebellion and my sin. Why dost thou hide thy face and consider me thy enemy? Wilt thou cause a driven leaf to tremble, or wilt thou pursue the dry chaff? For thou dost write bitter things against me, and thou dost make me to inherit the iniquities of my youth. Thou dost put my feet in stocks, and thou dost watch all my paths. Thou dost set a limit for the soles of my feet, and while I am decaying like a rotten thing, like a garment that is moth-eaten. And basically he's saying to God, he says, man, I'm a nothing, I'm a nobody. I mean, why are you singling me out? It's like you're just chasing a driven leaf that's just fallen off a tree. It's as good as dead. Why are you just hounding me? I mean, I'm a nothing, I'm a nobody. Why are you treating me like this? What have I done to you? Am I that much of a threat to you? Why don't you just leave me alone? That's basically what he's asking God to do. You know, he says, you put my feet in stocks. In other words, you've imprisoned me in all this pain and all this suffering. You watch my every move and you won't let me catch my breath. That's what he's basically saying to God. You know, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but like I said, when I first read this as a new Christian, I mean, I literally wept for the man. I just thought, boy, this poor guy, I just can't believe this one blow after another, after another, after another. And you try to put yourself in his shoes, and it's like, man, you think you got problems. You know, read this guy's life. And yet he, you know, in the midst of it all, he remained faithful to God. He didn't curse God, and like I said, his biggest frustration, which he's going to express, you know, later on, is that, hey, man, he can't find God. That was his biggest frustration. Every blow that he received, every loss that he experienced, he almost considered nothing in comparison to not being able to, you know, connect with God, because that was his biggest frustration. Anybody have anyone to add or share to that chapter 13? Okay, let's just go on. He continues his discourse here in chapter 14, when it's in verse 1. It says, man who is born of woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. Like a flower, he comes forth and withers. He also flees like a shadow and does not remain. Thou dost open thine eyes on him and bring him into judgment with thyself. Who can make the clean out of an unclean one? Since his days are determined and the number of his months is with thee, and his limits thou hast set so that he cannot pass, turn your gaze from him that he may rest until he fulfills his days like a hired hand. Back up. What he said in that verse 1? I mean, isn't this true? He says, man who is born a woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. I had read, I forget where exactly what it was that I read. I forget, out of some periodical. It may have been out of a newspaper, but it may have been a book. But I read that they say that basically nobody can go more than 2 weeks without having something happen in their life. Like either you come down with an illness, or your children get sick, or you get in a car wreck, or you know, you have a major repair problem, or you got something that you're hit with. For me, I think it's like I can't go 2 days without it. You know, right now I got my daughter's car, the transmission's blown on it, so it's in a shop. It's going to cost me probably $1,800 to get it out. And, you know, he's just like, he just can't get your breath. You know what I'm saying? You know, when Caleb came home last time, I mean, he went to his girlfriend's house to visit her and her parents, and then some guy, you know, with his car's parked out there, plowed into the back of his car and damaged the back end of it. And you know what they did? They left a worthless lottery ticket on the windshield like it was a note, you know, and they drove off. You know, that cost me over $500. I mean, every time I turn around, it's something. You just keep getting hit with this and that. And the other. I mean, read this again. Man who was born a woman is short-lived and full of turmoil. It is part of Job's argument, too. It's like, hey, man, just look at life. I mean, life is hard. It is a struggle. It is difficult. I mean, we are under a curse, right?
Yeah, he's already tried to do anything wrong.
Yeah.
It seems to have...
Yeah.
Whack you over the side of the head.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have to go looking for trouble, man. And here it is. It follows you around like a worthless dog, you know, every time, nipping at your heels every day. You know, so he says, anyway, he says in verse 2, he says, like a flower, he comes forth and withers. In other words, he's saying, this is our life. You know, we come forth and like a flower, I mean, we just wither and we die. That's it. He says, in verse 3, thou dost open thy eyes on him and bring him into judgment with thyself. It says, who can make the clean out of the unclean? In other words, what he's saying is that man's life, it is very short-lived. And it is. Even if you live to be 100 or more, it's a very short life. I mean, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. I look around and I was just studying back in Caleb's room. And I just saw this picture of him blowing his trumpet, you know, that's in his room. And, you know, I just think, look at this guy. He's a senior in college now. And it's like, where did the time go? I mean, I just remember, like it was yesterday, holding him in the palm of my hand. Mm-hmm. He weighed 5.5 pounds. Where has the time gone? Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it amazing? And that's, I mean, you look at your life, and it's here today, it's gone tomorrow. That's what Job is saying. We're like a flower that just withers, and that's it. When he says... You know, God's going to bring us into judgment. What does he also say? In verse 4 there, I think it says a lot. Who can make the clean out of the unclean? No one. I think that says two things, all right? That if a man is wicked, okay, then he's not going to be able to declare himself to be righteous, all right, before God. He's not going to have some worthless, flamboyant, good-for-nothing lawyer there saying, oh, he's innocent, he's good, you know, he hadn't done a thing. No, you're not going to be able to get away with that, you know, before God if you're wicked. At the same token, we're all... conceived in sin. That's what the Bible says. We are conceived in iniquity. In other words, our sinfulness is transmitted to us from our parents, and we keep transmitting it further and on down the line. Every generation that's born is a generation of sinners. Okay? They don't become sinners. They're born sinners. That's why they're sinners. So basically what he's saying here is that you know, we can't make ourselves clean. I mean, nobody's perfect is what he's saying. All right. So he's basically bringing this to God's attention that, hey, you know, even though I'm innocent, even though I'm righteous, even though I've done nothing wrong, I'm just a man. I'm imperfect. But, you know, cut me some slack as far as that's concerned. Anyway, he basically said that verse 5 too. He says, since his days are determined, the number of his months is with thee. We are told that in Psalms. We are told that God has numbered all our days. In other words, you know, even before we're born, he says, okay, I'm going to give this person X number of days, X number of months, or X number of years, whatever, and that's it. When that time is up, it's up. You know, I mean, I think that says a lot, because every one of these days, basically, is going to be reviewed, and we're going to have to give an account for. But they're numbered. And he says in that verse 6, he says, turn your gaze from him that he may rest. Job's talking... about himself, but he's talking about men in general, but he's talking specifically about himself. When he says, turn your gaze from him, it basically means turn your gaze from me that I may rest or that he may rest until he fulfills his days like a hired hand. In other words, as short-lived as our life is and as difficult as it is with all the work and stuff, you know, he's just basically asking God to just give him a little reprieve, give him a little breathing room, and let him enjoy a little bit of a life. And then he says in verse 7, he says, for there is hope for a tree when it is cut down, that it will sprout again, and its shoots will not fail. Though its roots grow old in the ground, and its stump dies in the dry soil, at the scent of water it will flourish and put forth its sprigs like plant. But man dies, and he lies prostrate. Man expires, and where is he? As water evaporates from the sea, and as the river becomes parched and dried up, so a man lies down and does not rise. Until the heavens be no more, he will not awake nor be aroused out of his sleep. Now, basically, what he's saying, he's using some metaphors here to describe when a man dies. He says, basically, when a tree, if a tree is cut down, if its roots are far enough into the ground, he says, it has hope of living again. You cut a tree down to a stump, and it's got real deep root system, and it has some nourishment, some water, it can sprout again. But if a man dies, you put him in a grave, he ain't coming out of that grave. there's no second chance for him. I don't care what the reincarnations will tell you. It's appointed unto every man to die once and then the judgment. So basically what he's saying is this, that for man, death is final. All right. I know he says this in that verse 12. It says, so man lies down and does not rise until the heavens be no more. Well, what he's saying here, I think Jehovah's Witnesses take this and they run off in a wrong direction. He's not saying that there's no consciousness after the grave or that there's not going to be a resurrection of the dead. You know, but what he's basically saying here is that death is permanent. It's as permanent as the heavens are. All right, it's fixed. You can't change it. You can't alter it. You can't come back. Remember years ago, there was a guy by the name of Houdini, many years ago, who he was an escape artist, and he you know, was always escaping from one death-defying feat after another, after another, after another. And he basically told his loved one, he says, listen, I'm going to try to escape death. If I die, I'm going to try to escape, and I'm going to make contact with you somehow. If there's a way, I'll get through to you. You know, well, nobody's ever heard from him again because, you know, this is what he's talking about here. For a man, there's no second chance here. There's no coming back. That's the end of it for the man. Verse 13, it says, oh, that thou wouldst hide me in Sheol, that thou wouldst conceal me until thy wrath is returns to thee, that thou wouldst set a limit for me and remember me. And basically, he's asking God this, that he would hide him in Sheol. Sheol is a name that signifies three things. It signifies the grave, it signifies hell, and it signifies the netherworld. It all depends upon the context of what is read there. But I think what he's talking about here is hide me in the netherworld. You know, the netherworld is where the souls would go after they died, before Christ opened the gates of heaven after his death and resurrection. You know, it's where Abraham's bosom was. It was called a place called paradise, where, you know, all the patriarchs and the people who believed in God in the Old Testament, well, they didn't go to heaven when they died because, you know, they were sinful men who needed to be redeemed by Christ's blood. And then after Christ died, okay, it says that he ascended into hell. Well, the hell was divided into two parts. One part was called paradise. The other place we call hell or torment. It was divided by a big chasm. Remember in Luke 16, I believe, that Jesus referred to when he talked about the rich man and Lazarus. Okay, mm-hmm. When they were separated there. Well, when Jesus died, he went down into another world, okay, otherwise known as Sheol. All right, and there he preached the good news, and after he rose from the dead, it says that he led many captives captive. In other words, he took everybody that was in paradise, and he brought them to heaven. Remember what he told the thief on the cross? He says, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. He didn't say that today thou shalt be with me in heaven, all right? People mixed the two of them together. No, that wasn't where he went, because Jesus didn't go to heaven after he died. You know, he went to Sheol. He went to the netherworld. He went to, you know, the place called paradise. He preached the good news after he rose from the dead. Then, when he ascended into heaven, it said he led captives, many captives. He took everybody, you know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all the patriarchs, and everybody that had died, who were waiting him to open the gates of heaven. He led captives captive. That's the way Paul describes it, I believe it's in Ephesians. All right. Well, I got way off on a tangent here, but I'm just talking about where he says, hide me in Sheol. In other words, either hide me in the grave or hide me in another world until your wrath has passed, and then call me forth when I can talk to you as a face-to-face, as man-to-man. That's basically what he's asking God to do. And he says in verse 14, if a man dies, will he live again? All the days of my struggle, I will wait until my change comes. In other words, until there's a change of heart on God's part when he might be able to talk to God face to face. In verse 15 he says, thou wilt call and I will answer thee, thou wilt long for the works of thy hands. He says, for now thou dost number my steps, thou dost not to observe my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and thou dost wrap up my iniquity. But the falling mountain crumbles away, and the rock moves from its place. Water wears away stones, and its torrents will wash away the dust of the earth. So thou dost destroy man's hope. And, you know, now he's slipping back in kind of a figurative speaking or language. What he's saying is here, it's just the same way that erosion takes place as far as, you know, mountains and as far as everything wearing away. He's saying his hope is being washed away or worn away or eroded away because, you know, the more he hopes that God will speak to him, that God will talk to him, he feels this sense of despair that he's not going to be able to stand before God, you know, and make his argument before him. A lot of people have experienced in that where, you know, you may be going through a lot of trials, and then you get to the point where the hope that you have, you know, begins to erode, or you feel like, well, let's say it's a physical illness, and you keep coming to God in prayer, and praying for healing, and then, you know, after so many days or months or weeks or years, your hope just begins to erode away. Well, that's the way Job was feeling. And he says in verse 20, he says, that thou dost forever overpower him, and he departs, but thou dost change his appearance and sends him away. What does he mean by thou dost change his appearance and sends him away? Well, just look in the mirror and see if your appearance is not changing. It's like, hey, the older a person gets, I mean, is your appearance changing? I mean, I wait upon old people every day. I mean, they say they bring them in the busloads, and they're coming in with walkers, with canes. They're in marked cars. They're shuffling along. They're stooped over. I mean, they're shaking. Their hair's all falling out. It completely turned white. And and it's like, I have to sit there and I have to exercise a lot of patience when I deal with them, because it's like, you know, I think, well, I'm getting there real quick myself. So, you know, I better be patient with these people. But it's like, oh gosh, it's like, they'll fumble for their change for 5 minutes, and it's like I got long lines behind me, and it's like they're totally oblivious that, hey, you know what, there's somebody behind you. It's like, oh, I think I got 3 cents, you know, and they're just fumbling. It's like, oh, hey, let me get it for you, you know? I just feel like saying, you know, and then some of them are just so crabby. It's like, you give them your change, and they're like, I said, get the right change. Just barely. You know? It's like, oh, Lord. Were these people born this way? No. It's like, hey, their appearance changes, right? I mean, this is what he's talking about here when he says here, in verse 20, thou dost forever overpower him, and he departs. Thou dost change his appearance, and he sends him away, or he dies, right? I mean, this is what happens. This is part of life, part of death, part of dying. Verse 21, it says, his sons achieve honor, but he does not know it, or they become insignificant, but he does not perceive it. But his body pains him, and he mourns only for himself. In other words, you get up at a certain point in age where your mind fails and your body fails, or you're in chronic pain or something, and it's not even, it's like you're only aware of your own suffering and not of the good things that are happening even to your own children, because you're at death's door. You're standing at that threshold. And basically that's what Job is basically saying. Hey, man, my life is just here today, gone tomorrow. Give me a break. Take your heavy hand from me.
Dying a little bit at a time.
Right. Yeah. Does anybody have anyone to add or share to that? Yeah. Well, listen, we do have a lot of time left. We can just quickly go through this with chapter 15. Because now Eliphaz is going to respond to Job. Now, here's an interesting thing about this, the way that this book is broken up. It's like 42 chapters, so I'm trying to go through it quickly, because we could be in this book for months on end. But the story, you know, it's just flowing. That's why I want to keep reading it rather than do a lot of commenting on each part of it, because a lot of it is self-explanatory. But one of the problems, too, is a lot of it is kind of written in prose or kind of written in a poetry form of literature, where sometimes you wonder, well, exactly what is he saying here or what does he mean there? You know. But here's the interesting thing is now Eliphaz is going to respond to Job. But you see, this happens, this dialogue takes place in three different cycles. In other words, it started off with Eliphaz, and then it went to Bildad, and then it went to Zophar. All right, and Job responded to each one of their comments. All right, and remember, Eliphaz was accusing Job basically of being a sinner based upon his own observation of how things work in the universe, how God works. Then Bildad basically accused Job of being a sinner because of past tradition, that God always, you know, look in the past and you'll see that's the way things have always been. And Zophar, you know, makes his argument that, hey, man, God knows you're a worthless, good-for-nothing sinner. I mean, you just need to come clean. I mean, Zophar didn't mince around with words. So, in other words, his three friends have basically attacked him and accused him of being a sinful. He's responded to each one of them. All right, and we just read Job's response to Zophar. But his response to Zophar was also coupled with, you know, his dialogue to God. Now it's starting all over again. Now the second cycle begins, and now Eliphaz is now starting to speak to Job again. And he says in that verse 1, it says, then Eliphaz the Temanite responded, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? In other words, he's basically saying, Job, you're just full of hot air. That's basically what he's saying to Job. He says, should he argue with useless talk or with words which are not profitable? Indeed, you do away with reverence and hinder the meditations before God. For your guilt teaches your mouth, and you choose the language of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you, and not I, and your own lips testify against you. And basically what he's saying to Job, he says, you're saying you're innocent, but you're full of hot air. And you're basically accusing God of being unjust, and you know that's not the case because you're getting just what you deserve. Basically, that's what he's saying to him. All right? And then in verse 7 it says, were you the first man to be born, or were you brought forth before the hills? In other words, do you know it all, Job? Were you around before any other man? He's being sarcastic with Job here, but he's basically just insulting him. He says, do you hear the secret counsel of God and limit the wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know, and what do you understand that we do not? Both the gray-haired and the age are among us, older than your father. Are the consolations of God too small for you, even the word spoken gently with you? Why does your heart carry you away, and why do your eyes flash? In other words, he's saying, hey, Job, why are you all angry? Why are you uptight? Like that verse 10, both the gray-haired and the aged are among us, and older than your father. In other words, there's a lot of older men who, you know, been around for a long time and a lot longer than you, Job, and they will tell you that what we're saying to you is true. All right? That God basically punishes the wicked and he rewards the righteous. That's their whole argument. So based on that logic, they're saying that, Job, you're just a worthless, good-for-nothing monster of iniquity, and you just got to come clean. I mean, can you put yourself in this guy's shoes? You got nobody. Even your friends have now turned against you and are kicking you when you're down. What would you do? I mean, what would you do if you were one of Job's friends? What would you do? What could you do besides just put your arm around him and just weep with him? Because there's nothing you can say. All right? But now, these people, they're not consoling him. They're not comforting him. Their intention was to do that. But after 7 days, and then the devil gets involved, and look at the way the devil works, all right? It was Eliphaz that the devil appeared to, and when Eliphaz saw him, he couldn't make him out. He says it was a spirit. He couldn't make out the form, but he says Eliphaz said that my hair stood up on my back, and he was frightened. He was terrified, but Eliphaz thought it was, you know, a spirit from God. Because the Spirit said to him, hey, can I, basically a man made of clay, be righteous before God? That's basically what the devil was suggesting. Look, isn't that the way the devil always works? Mm-hmm. Look at how he got the first parents to sin, our first parents. He posed a question. You know, did God say you shouldn't eat it from this fruit? And this, he does this to Eliphaz. He says, can a man be righteous before God? You know, so that was his whole implication. The devil didn't have to come out and say, you know what? Job's a worthless, good-for-nothing sinner. That's why he's being punished. No, he just posed a question to Eliphaz. And Eliphaz fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, and ran with it. And then he says, verse 11, it says, are the consolations of God too small for you, even the words spoken gently with you? In other words, God is showing consolation to God through his friend. In other words, they feel like, hey, we've been sympathetic with you. Referring to their sympathy, but obviously their sympathy has definitely turned on them, all right? And they think that they're talking for God, because in verse 12 it says, why does your heart carry you away, and why does your eye flash, and why are you all upset? Why are you angry? I mean, you only get what you deserve is what's implied there. And verse 13 says, that you should turn your spirit against God and allow such words to go out of your mouth. What is man that he should be pure, or he who is born of woman that he should be righteous? He says, behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones or his angels, and the heavens are not pure in his sight. Well, what he's saying is true, all right? What he's saying is true, but that's what I mean. You have to use exercise discernment, because a lot of what Job's friends say, it's true in and of itself, all right? One of the things that I see, like, for example, when people get involved in cults, is that they will take things that are true and they will preach them out of context, or they will preach it out of balance until it becomes heresy. I see this over and over and over again with people who get into false religions or get into cults or get into, you know, heretical teachings. Is that they don't take everything in the light of all other scripture, and that's what Eliphaz is doing, that's what Bildad is doing, Zophar is doing, and he's basically saying the truth, but he's misapplying it. When he says, behold, he puts no trust in his holy ones, and the heavens are not pure in his sight, Well, compared to God, not even angels are perfect. It says, how much less one who is detestable and corrupt man who drinks iniquity like water. So in other words, he's saying, Job, if God can find fault with the heavens or the angels, surely, Job, he can find fault with a man who drinks iniquity like water, implying to Job, you are such a sinner. You are such a gross, flagrant, good-for-nothing monster of iniquity. You got what you deserved, and the only way you're going to get out of this is to come clean and confess your sin. That's what they're basically saying to him. Verse 17 says, I will tell you, listen to me, and what I have seen I will also declare. What wise men have told and have not concealed from their fathers, to whom alone the land was given, and no alien passed among them, and the wicked man writhes in pain all of his days, and numbered are the years stored up for the ruthless. Says, sounds of terror are in his ears, while at peace the destroyer comes upon him. He does not believe that he will return from darkness, and he is destined for the sword. He wanders about for food, saying, where is it? And he knows that a day of darkness is at hand. Distress and anguish terrify him. They overpower him like a king ready for the attack, because he has stretched out his hand against God, and he conducts himself arrogantly against the Almighty. He rushes headlong at him, and with his massive shield, for he has covered his face with his fat, and has made his thighs heavy with flesh. He has lived in desolate cities and in houses no one would inhabit, which are destined to become ruins. He will not become rich, nor will his wealth endure, and his grain will not bend down to the ground. He will not escape from darkness. The flame will wither his shoots, and by the breath of his mouth he goes away. Let him not trust in emptiness, deceiving himself, for emptiness will be his reward. It will be accomplished before his time, and his palm branch will not be green. He will drop off his unripened grape like the vine, and will cast off his flower like the olive tree. For the company of the godless is barren, and the fire consumes the tents of the corrupt. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity, and their mind prepares deception. Now, the reason I read this, the whole thing through, is because basically Eliphaz's argument is this. He's using, I think, example after example after example that he's coming up with to show that, hey, the wicked are always punished. You know, the wicked are always going to be brought before God and severely chastised. They're not going to be able to take root for very long before, you know, God just comes down on them like a ton of bricks. That's basically what he's saying in his argument. He's using one metaphor after another to try to substantiate where he's coming from. But you tell me. I mean, I have seen it. Not only through my own experience, but I've just seen it in history through a lot of my own reading. Like, you know, I read, for example, a number of books on, you know, the Soviet Union. And I read The Death of Stalin. That was one of the books that I read. And I read about his life. And I thought to myself, here's a man who one of the biggest mass murderers in history, or Mao Zedong. He was probably the biggest mass murderer in history. I mean, between the two of them, they murdered, tens of millions of people. All right. But look at the way the two of them died. They died old men in their bed. At peace, you know, with all their wealth intact, with everything that they accumulated in life still at their fingertips. They didn't die in destitution, did they? They didn't die in abject poverty or, you know, from some curse that Eliphaz is trying to imply that, hey, man, if you just look around you, you will see that the wicked are punished, you know, every single time. Well, I don't see that. Do you see that? I just don't see it. And on the contrary, very often what I've seen is that people who fear God, who love God, who are committed to God, they experience a great deal of tribulation, a great deal of trouble, a great deal of trial. I mean, but that's what we're told in Peter, right? It's through many tribulations and distress that we're going to enter the kingdom of God. We are told that by Paul in Corinthians, you know, that we're going to experience all kinds of difficulties in life, but God will sustain us through them. I mean, this is what my experience has been. I mean, I wouldn't think for one minute, well, the wicked are always punished and the righteous are always rewarded. Hey, that common sense would tell you that, right? If the wicked were always punished and they were punished, I think, pretty quickly, and the righteous were always rewarded and they were rewarded in a timely fashion, how many wicked people do you think we've running around here? Common sense tells you that, right? I mean, I'm appalled at what the wicked get away with and for how long they get away with it. Aren't you? How many serial killers are running around this country right now? They've been killing people left and right, and they've been doing it for years and never got caught. The ones we do catch, you know, they're few and far between. See what I'm saying? I, like I said, I look at people like in the ACLU, you know, these people who are just God-haters, who blaspheme God day and night, and they are at war with him, and, you know, they will never pass up an opportunity to strengthen the hands of the wicked or to oppose the righteous, and yet they'll live on and on and on in ease and luxury and wealth and prosperity and material things, right? I mean, this has been my experience. And so, in essence, what Eliphaz is saying is all bunk, and Job sees it, Job knows it. Job's going to respond to him. We don't have any time to get into that tonight, but Job doesn't see it.
Well, David, Psalm 73, he was going through the same thing, thinking, what is the problem here? All these, why do the wicked prosper? Seem to prosper.
Right.
And then he said, one of the scriptures, he said, verse 3, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then understood I their end.
Right.
Because at the very end, he knows, like even when Stalin died on his deathbed, almost a peaceful way, it should have been, just, he's got his coming.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, that's what, yeah, good point, because it does say in that psalm that David said that he was really distressed about how the wicked were flourishing in life until he went into the temple of God, the presence of God, and he sat down before him, and then God just kind of opened his heart or his mind to the realization that, hey, man, their end is coming very, very soon. I mean, they're here today and they're gone tomorrow. And then what? Then they're going to have to stand before God and give an account. Then they will be punished. Just in closing, take for example the rich man and Lazarus. We just used them as kind of a, you know, I mentioned them earlier. I don't know how long the rich man lived, all right, but I assume that he lived on and on. Because what it says there is the rich man, so he just lived sumptuously. I mean, he just ate, you know, the fat of the land, and he feasted, and he wore all these fancy clothes and all these expensive garments, and, you know, he lived in the lap of luxury. And here Lazarus is at the gate of his home, all right, where he's too sick to even move around much, and the dogs are licking his sores that he has on. And he longs to fill himself with just the crumbs that fall from the rich man's table, right? But then it says that Lazarus dies, and then the rich man died. Now, I don't know how long that rich man lived on, but he probably lived on for a long time. Right, but what happened when he died, man? Then he got his just rewards, because then he was in hell and he saw Lazarus off in Abraham's bosom. He says, "Hey, man, Father Abraham, send Lazarus over here, you know, with a drop of water to cool my tongue. I'm in agony in this flame." He may have seemed to have lived on and on, but you know, in the light of eternity, it was just a blink of an eye, and then things were set right. So, anyway, I want to add or share?